When I was a boy each week, on Sunday we would go to church, pay attention to the priest, and he would read the holy word, and consecrate the holy bread, and everyone would kneel and bow. Today the only difference is everything is holy now. Everything, everything, everything is holy now. And when I was in Sunday school, we would learn about the time Moses
blessed. This is Mormon Stories. I'm John DeLynn. Joanna Brooks grew up in a conservative Mormon home among the last great orange groves of Orange County, California. She attended Brigham Young University and received her PhD from the University of California, Los Angeles. Her first book, American Lazarus, Religion and the Rise of African American and Native American Literatures, was awarded the Modern Language Association William Sanders Scarborough Prize. Brooks has also received awards from the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Woodrow Wilson Foundation, and the American Philosophical Society for her scholarship on religion and American culture. Her writing about contemporary Mormonism has been published in Religion Dispatches, Killing the Buddha, Sunstone, and Dialogue, and featured in the New York Times and on National Public Radio's Radio West. She has also published award-winning poetry, fiction, and nonfiction in literary journals such as, help me out here, Joanna.
Ziziva
and Blue Mesa Review. In 2009, she was awarded a residency at the Hedgebrook Women Writers Retreat to work on a memoir about growing up Mormon. She lives in San Diego with her husband, two children, and an adopted res dog named Mosey?
Mosey.
Joanna Brooks, welcome to Mormon Stories.
John, it's a pleasure and an honor to be on Mormon Stories 2.0.
Thank you. Well, When I attended BYU, I got home from my mission around 1990, and when I arrived and started getting into the groove, I started hearing these rumblings of concerns about academic freedom, about feminism, about just all sorts of even pro-choice kind of rallies. And the names Joanna Brooks and Brian Waterman sort of always seemed to surface. Now, at the time, I was sort of just this shell-shocked, return missionary who was trying to come to grips with the tough mission experience, and still sort of clinging to my Bruce R. McConkie and Joseph Fielding Smith sort of orthodox doctrinal upbringing. And you guys were making all these waves. And so that is sort of how I came to first hear the name Joanna Brooks. But Joanna Brooks was a student at BYU while I was there, and did some amazing things at a very young age and has continued to do amazing things ever since. So Joanna...
That's really sweet of you.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, thank you very much. Well, that's sort of a little context for what we may be a part of what we're going to talk about today.
Right.
So Joanna... Before we actually dive into the BYU days a little bit, I thought it might make sense to back up and have you talk about your upbringing in the church. And, you know, the first question that came to my mind is, what type of experience growing up would lead to a BYU student being such an activist, such a strong activist at such a young age? So take us back in the time machine and tell us about your Mormon upbringing, whatever you want to tell us, and how that led to sort of those first inklings of activism at BYU.
Goodness gracious. I don't know if I know how, well, I'll try to answer that question. But I grew up, it's easy to start with my parents and talk about my family. How Mormon is that? Let's talk about my genealogy.
That's all right. That's all right.
You know, my mom's mom, who I was very close to, was born and raised in Garland from, you know, pioneer stock family. They'd converted in England in the 1850s and come across. Her father's side of the family were among the founders of Lehigh. They had a dugout out there. Thornton was the family name. And her mother's side of the family were early settlers in Samaria and Malad, Idaho. And so, you know, deep pioneer roots on that side, although not entirely traditional. She left Salt Lake during kind of a middle to the end of the Depression and came to Los Angeles, where she met my grandfather, who wasn't LDS, and married him. And then my mom grew up in a Southeast LA suburb. My dad also grew up in a Southeast LA suburb. His family were Okies, basically, and my grandmother basically the family had come into contact with Mormonism while picking cotton in Arizona in the 1920s in Gilbert area, and then moved out west to Los Angeles. And so my parents met at a steak dance,
awesome.
A young adult dance, right after my dad had gotten home from his mission, and, you know, went to BYU together, fell in love, moved back to Southern California. And, you know, although neither of them had come from what you might call truly Orthodox Mormon homes, they committed their entire lives to raising us in, you know, the most, you know, observant and devout of Mormon ways. And so, you know, I grew up, you know, my dad was a bishop, you know, went to primary, the whole, you know, seminary, the whole nine yards. We would reenact Mormon Battalion trek, you know, hikes in San Diego on Mormon Battalion Day every year. You know, I mean, we did it. I went to Utah every summer. We did our genealogy, food stores, yada, 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 yada. Whole nine yards.
Even dance festivals, right?
Oh, one of the happiest moments of my Mormon youth. No, I mean, really, dance festivals, girls' camp, personal progress. Loved it, and loved being LDS. And, you know, and from the time I was a child, like, my faith meant everything to me. And I had, from when I was very little, like, very strong spiritual experiences. And, you know, a lot of them, for me, from the time I was very young, I had some, like, really, really powerful dreams where I had, you know, experiences where I felt really close to God from the time I was really young. And just made such a deep imprint on me. And, you know, also all the good things the church teaches about caring for one another and, you know, basic Christian values too, about caring for the poor and being prepared. Deep impressions on me. And then finally, I think too, growing up in the 70s and 80s, I think I was sort of alert to some of it was the Cold War, right? So it was sort of end times consciousness on the front of my head. And, you know, my mom has told me about this one story when I was like 6 years old and we were chatting in the kitchen and, you know, and I said to her, Mom, is it true that when Jesus comes back, he's going to take away all the pollution and people are going to stop saying bad words and be kind to each other? And she said, yes, honey, it's true. And, you know, and I started crying. And so I think from the time I was really little, a really big part of my faith, and there you can hear my own daughter in the background.
No, it's all right. We're keeping it real.
We're keeping it real. That's what 4 years old sounds like. you know, I think from the time I was very, very young, a huge component of my own faith was this hunger for a better world. You know, it was a hunger for a world where there was more kindness, a hunger for a world where there was more justice, and a deep faith that it was God's intention to that wounds be healed, right, in the long term,
right.
You know, and I think that was just a core component of my faith, that deep hunger for healing in a world that, from when I was little, I knew had some brokenness to it, right? You know, it was the 1970s, pollution, right? You know,
right.
That was what you're teaching us. So anyway, so I don't think that ever left me. And my faith, you know, and being Mormon and socializing with Mormon kids, that remained like the core defining facet of who I was all through high school. I mean, I remember really vividly starting high school and kind of my non-LDS friends kind of taking one route, and I just kind of consciously knew I had to go another route. Like, I didn't feel like I could associate anymore, since they were starting to, you know, sow their wild oats, and that was just not something I could do. So, like, again, like, my faith meant everything to me, and I often felt fairly alone, even though I ran with this wonderful gang of Mormon kids in Orange County. I mean, I love the kids I grew up with. You know, some of the most like genuine, fun, sweet young men and young women, you know, and we caused all kinds of trouble, you know, like in the best sort of way, you know.
Burning couches.
My brother's friends burned the couches. Like, you know, what did we do? I mean, we ice blocked down grassy hills in like new housing developments and got chased by the police. What the police were doing that they had time to chase kids riding ice blocks down grassy hills.
Right.
It's a different world. Anyway, so I looked from when I was as young as I could remember, I really looked forward. I mean, I couldn't wait to go to BYU. I was so excited to go to BYU because I really had this feeling that when I went to BYU, I would finally be understood, right? I would be among people who would get me finally, instead of kind of feeling like this, you know, a religious minority with this kind of worldview that I could barely explain to other people, right? Because that's how we carry our faith in Mormonism oftentimes, especially when we're young. It's so close to our heart. It's so hard to explain the incredibly intense and tender feelings and experiences that congregate around our Mormonism, you know, that I would go to this place, I'd be understood, and, you know, I would meet the one.
Right.
It would be great.
Now, you know, let me ask, so in parallel to that, were you reading Martin Luther King? Were you studying the hippies of the early 70s? I mean, was there any, you know, activist sort of seedlings that were sprouting in parallel during high school?
I mean, oh, so funny. When I was in fourth grade, I chose to do my term paper on the Equal Rights Amendment. And it was 1980, 81, right? And so it was the height of the church's involvement in anti-ERA politics. So, of course, you know, I'm nine, and I have this sense that this ERA is really interesting, right?
Right.
But I have access to no information for my term paper except for this array of Phyllis Schlafly Eagle Forum pamphlets that my mother has like collected. So
right.
I remember sitting down at the kitchen table with her and like researching my term paper on the ERA, you know, through Phyllis Schlafly, you know.
Right.
And
right.
I mean, so, you know, I think when I got to high school, I think I got some access to like Thoreau. I think I still own the copy of Civil Disobedience I purchased when I was like a junior in high school that was underlined with all these goofy happy faces in the margin. You know, like who puts happy faces in the margin of Thoreau? A 16-year-old girl in Orange County, right? You know,
right.
Like, so, I, you know, there are glimmers. I had such strong feelings. I wrote for the school paper too and had this big voice that would come out and I would get in trouble for sometimes. But I didn't have like the dots connected and the resources to kind of articulate. There were Democrats where I lived. I mean, you know, not even the Jewish folks I grew up around were Democrats, really. I mean, it was like Orange County, California,
right.
Republican Valhalla. You know, so
right.
I just had no name for what I was, you know.
So you did not go to BYU with Malcolm X on your tongue?
No, although, you know, although I knew I was different because I had grown up, you know, kind of at the edge of the Book of Mormon belt. You know, I didn't grow up, you know, Idaho, Utah. I had more exposure to difference and, you know, to people of color, maybe just a little bit more. So I had some sense of a difference, but I didn't come with like, you know, my parents did not read Sunstone, you know, like
right, right.
We were church news people who voted Republican and collected Phyllis Schlafly Eagle Forum pamphlets. That's who we were.
And what about like, you know, had you heard of Sunstone? Had you heard of Michael
no.
Quinn? Had you
no.
heard
no.
of Fawn Brody? You know, had you done any studying into the history at all?
No.
Oh, wow.
No. I didn't even know it existed.
Oh, my goodness.
I didn't even know it existed. I had no clue. On the shelves of my folks' house were Cleon Skousen
right.
and the Journal of Discourses. I am not kidding. And a collection of National Geographic picture books.
Okay.
You know, like none of it.
Okay, so here's the question. What happened?
That's why I don't know how to answer you. I don't know.
Okay, so you're a freshman. You go to BYU. What led to you leading, you know, academic freedom marches, you know, on campus?
Well, here's the thing. Imagine this. I was a freshman And during orientation, I mean, and mind you, I'd had this kind of noumenal consciousness and just this kind of, I guess, just a really empathetic disposition. It's just who I am as a person, right? So this had I'd been carrying around. And also, I think growing up being like a young woman in Orange County in a very conservative culture that really didn't value brainy girls, like brainy girls. Right. And brainy Mormon girls who did not party. So useless. So useless. I mean, I remember looking up on the wall of my like high school with all the pictures of the ASB presidents. There hadn't been a female ASB student body president in the entire history of my high school. Girls like me were useless. Right. We were so useless. And I got different messages at church that, you know, yeah, I did have a leadership role and that, you know. So anyway, so I was a woman and was self-conscious about being a brainy young woman. And I was a terrifically empathetic young person. Okay, so I get to BYU during freshman orientation, just as kind of, you know, a routine part of my little like freshman interest group orientation. We were conducted into this classroom in the basement of the JKHB, and introduced to like this professor who was going to kind of give us a little, the only intellectual dose of our orientation, you know, in addition to the eating ice cream malts and hiking to the Y, all of which was awesome.
Right.
But it was Eugene England, right? And he looks at us and he takes out the Book of Mormon and he takes us the scripture in 2 Nephi where it says, all are likened to God, you know, male and female, black and white, bond and free. And he says to us, so what do you think this means? And it was just like a door opened up in my heart, you know, just like a door opened up. And just, you know, and you know, I credit Mormon culture with so much of my intellectual curiosity as a person, you know, like being taught to really seek out the nature of reality, even in these really challenging, fascinating ways, like Joseph Smith frames it in the Doctrine and Covenants. You know, and it was one of those moments like, wow, just the world became technicolor. And this, I stepped into just the smallest circle of this Mormon intellectual liberal world that was really beginning to emerge, you know, in the late 80s and early 90s as a public culture at BYU. You know, I mean, there'd been a long Mormon liberal tradition, of course, but I think there was something special happening in the late 80s. And the early 90s, and I arrived just in time, you know, to see the BYU self-consciously hire feminists, you know, self-consciously hiring declared feminist literary theorists, right? You know?
Right, right.
And, you know, and postmodernists, and, you know, and this experiment happening. I remember when I was recruited, I went to BYU on a Benson scholarship, you know, and I remember when they said, oh, come, it's a good place for you, come. We're changing, it's become so much more competitive to get in, and we're really recruiting faculty that are really, you know, pursuing all these kind of, you know, interesting, and, you know, and that moment was really flowering when I got there, and it was the first time I'd ever tasted it, and it was so delicious.
Ah, so you're recruited by Eugene England.
Well, I first met Eugene, like, after I was there as a freshman. They'd gotten me without Eugene England, but, you know.
No, I meant Into the Dark Side. I'm just kidding. I'm totally kidding. So I don't know, like, were you on the student review?
Yeah.
Okay, so tell our listeners, believe it or not, I guarantee you 80% of our listeners have no idea what the student review even was. Oh. So describe it, if you can.
Long live the student review. Okay, so it was the other paper, right? There was the Daily Universe, which was the on-campus, forgive me, I know there's some universe former stuff, right? It was the lab paper, right, where you were getting trained to write for the AP, you know, and you know, it covered the news of the campus and the community. But then there was the student review, which was everything else. It was student-run by geniuses like B.J. Fogg, Eric Schultzke, like geniuses who somehow in their spare time as college students – managed to recruit enough advertising to pay for a weekly newspaper that was somewhere between 12 and 24 pages. For a few years, we had it going in full color, that published features on, you know, features on BYU life-related issues, but also, like, kind of standard Mormon intellectual fair. It was like Sunstone Junior, and there was a humor section, and there was kind of an opinion section, and a news section, and cultural event section, a calendar. I mean, the Student Review was one of the very, very first newspapers to cover the Sundance Film Festival when it was just a baby event up the canyon. You know, I mean, so it was this marvelous gathering. You know, we would hold recruitment meetings in the Honors Building, so it became like the magnet for all of the geeky Brady kids who came from their small towns in, you know, northern Arizona, you know, and felt not understood until they found all the other geeky Mormon kids who were worshiping Gene England. And that's where I met Brian Waterman.
That's where you met Brian?
Oh, that's where I met everybody.
And yeah. And you guys recruited in the Mazur Building?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. We held recruitment meetings right there in the Honors Building.
And yeah. How did the administration view the Student Review?
Well, you know, a lot of things happened in the Honors Building that were not happening other places. It's all those bad Brady kids. You know, I mean, from benign, you know, benign neglect, you know, just outright ignoring it, to once, though, the grounds crew once confiscated our entire print run and started throwing it into the furnaces at like the physical plant on the southeast edge of campus, until Jesse Curtis, who some of you might be a name familiar to some of your listeners, who was our distribution guy, went and physically like charged into the physical plant and pulled bundles of papers like out of the furnace, out of the incinerator.
So was it like secret who was running it? I mean, did you put your names, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and you didn't get kicked out of the university for doing it.
No. I mean, and that's the thing. I mean, I think, you know, it really didn't take much at BYU to kind of mark something as outsider. You know, I mean, just the fact that we weren't the company brand of newspaper meant that we weren't dangerous, right? So, I mean, you know, and some of it, like, for a year or two, I ran the humor section, and it was hilarious and fun and totally sweet and benign. I mean, we weren't always looking for controversy. We were just looking for fun. You know, we would do things like find ways to sneak into campus building and spend the night, or like, you know, like find our way into the steam tunnels under campus. And, you know, I mean, we were just like geeky kids who wanted more fun than like, let's have some chips and salsa and watch The Little Mermaid again at your apartment. You
know? So it wasn't like, you know, forbidden. It wasn't like something that, you know, the administrators would have come after you for. It was just something that wasn't official, that had to kind of be underground. And that,
yeah.
You tried to distribute on campus, right?
We weren't allowed to distribute on campus, but whatever. All you had to do is drop a stack in the library. You know,
right.
I mean, it was, you know, what is a big campus, what they're going to do.
Right. Were there any articles that that got people in trouble?
Yes.
Or give us an example of a row or two that maybe the Student Review caused.
Two that come to mind right away. My freshman year, right when I started writing for the paper, I was a freshman in the dorms, and I'd written for my school paper back at home, and I knew I was a writerly type, you know, and so I went. I remember walking to my first Student Review meeting so vividly. Anyway, and I had written this paper about standards. You know, standards was kind of creepy when I was a freshman at BYU. You know, the Office of the Honor Code Enforcement, you know, and there were kind of weird vigilante forces. I had some friends who had some bad run-ins with standards, you know, and dorm mothers spying on people and turning them into standards, and you know, roommates being encouraged to spy on roommates and turn them into standards. And it creeped me out, you know. And so I don't even remember what it was in it, but I wrote this sort of expose of standards, you know, in which I talked about how, you know, there was this kind of, you know, recruiting of information about other students that standards was doing that was subject, could be abused, you know, and that was kind of introducing a weird, creepy atmosphere. And that didn't go over very well with my dorm mother.
Right.
Confronted me one night. It was like, I remember this. It was like early in the morning. I was finals or something. I was buying a candy bar in the basement of Stover Hall at Helaman Halls. And my dorm in my jammies, right? And my dorm mother comes out and says, "You're here on a scholarship. How dare you write those things about this university?" You know, And I'm standing there, I'm like 18. I'm not trying to hurt anybody. I just have, you know, this big geeky brain, sort of a civil liberties penchant, and a fierce pen, right? You know, right. And I felt awful. I felt sad, but I also felt angry. I'm like, well, you know, I didn't say anything to her. I just kind of went back to my room, but I was like, you know, you're 60 years old. I'm 18. Why do you think I'm going to wreck the church? I just don't think that roommates should be encouraged to rat out roommates who are having like behavioral difficulties. You know, like,
something comes to mind. Like, I'm thinking about my state of mind when I'm a freshman at BYU, and you know, the last thing I would have wanted to do was to make waves or challenge authority. Like, for me, BYU administration was, you know, pretty much like being a general authority, which was pretty much like being, you know, an apostle of God. And so, like, I would never have been as bold, and I would have been feeling this sort of gnawing guilt or loss of the spirit, as I would have interpreted back then. But just these feelings of cognitive dissonance and of being rebellious, and, you know, all the things that the scriptures would speak out against. Were you experiencing any of that? I mean, like, did you ever feel like, hey, I'm not supporting my leaders and following the Holy Ghost, and, you know, however you would have framed it as a believing Mormon?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind, this sounds so goofy, is, I mean, I guess it came from having a lot of bad seminary teachers who were sent by church educational systems, you know?
Right.
Like, I somewhere along the way, I must have, and it may have just been being sort of a prideful, I don't know. I mean, you know, somewhere along the way, I learned that, you know, just because people who worked for church education system said or did something, it wasn't gospel, you know, and that there were some basic principles about dignity and respect and privacy that deserved to be honored, but I would never been able to articulate that back then. You know, maybe I was just an exceptionally hard-headed kid. I mean, but at the same time, I did feel shame. I did feel shame. I absolutely felt shame. I felt sad. I didn't want to be bad.
Right.
I didn't want to be bad at all. I just, like, observed some things that I thought were potentially damaging. I mean, it had come from friends of mine who'd come to BYU who had been having some struggles and were kind of hurt. Were trying to do the right thing, right? But got caught in a bad moment, and suddenly their whole education, their whole ability to stay at BYU was on the line, and that just wasn't right to me.
So did you feel like your religious sensibilities were actually informing your activism? Like, where was your heart?
You know, I think what it was, and I would have never been able to articulate this at the time, was, you know, I had friends who were struggling and had made some mistakes and got caught at this very vulnerable time and, you know, hurt by an institution that thought it had their best interest at heart. And I really hated to see people who were vulnerable or struggling being made to feel bad. You know, that really upset me. I thought that was wrong. And I think that's kind of, if there's a consistent thread to it all, you know, it's that kind of fierce compassion informed it.
Did you feel like your testimony of, or your perception of what Jesus or the Savior was or is like, in was sort of the backbone or informed that?
You know, I wouldn't have thought of it. I would not have thought of it in that way. I think for me it was more like Mormonism should be a place where we can come home to each other, right? You know, and these folks have made it here, and like, we should be safe with one another. We should be loving to one another. You know, people are human and they're going to have mistakes, and their vulnerability is part of their, you know, it's part of their spiritual story. And why are people being put on the spot, and kind of, you know, young people too, why are people being targeted when they're struggling? That's not right.
Right.
That's not what this should be. We should be a home to one another, you know?
Sure.
They're not a threat to, you know, these people aren't a threat. You know, and that leads, I think, to the second big row at Student Review that I personally was involved in was, you know, my sophomore year, I was the editor of the focus section. We did like issues oriented stuff, and we did a whole issue on homosexuality. And this was 1990.
Was John Hammer part of that?
John was our layout guy, so he didn't write any copy. But, you know, I mean, look, you know. There were gay folks working at the Student Review. Now, they weren't out to themselves. They, you know, they weren't out to anybody. They were college. They were Mormon college students, geeky, smart Mormon college students coming to terms with who they were. But there were folks there who have subsequently come out, you know. And so we did a whole issue on homosexuality.
Okay, wait. So I'm trying, like, what year were you a freshman?
I was a freshman, 89, 90. And so it was during 90, 91
okay.
We did a whole issue.
Okay, so... I'm trying to think about where I was in 87 or 88 or 90, you know, as a freshman or sophomore.
Yeah.
My mind was not in a place of empathy for homosexuality. I mean, you know, the AIDS thing and Magic Johnson and, you know, it was just like, it was not post-Ellen, post-Rosie
no, it was
America. Early. I mean, and so within Mormon America, that you just didn't go there. I mean, that was just like evil, perverted stuff. So like, what would have made you guys want to touch that issue back then? Like, were there personal, were there like people you knew, friends you had?
You know, there were stories that I had heard that, you know, again, like some part, I mean, some were meeting people, one or two people who alluded that this was something they were wrestling with, right, at BYU, you know, and... You know, again, only in the most indirect of ways, and just because I was kind of perceptive, could I kind of pick up and then we could kind of communicate about this was something people were struggling with, you know, and we'd all read The Miracle of Forgiveness. You know, we'd all knew that according to, you know, beloved prophet Spencer Kimball, who is like my favorite, you know, that homosexuality was just an expression of degradation, and the next step was bestiality, you know, and kind of sitting with that profound discomfort that these surfaces rubbing together caused and saying, okay, here's beloved prophet, here are these real lives, and then beginning to hear also stories that, you know, BYU hadn't been involved in, you know, the electroshock treatments. This was circulating. This was kind of circulating in the ether at the time. And so watching these surfaces come together, a culture I loved, a prophet I loved, and people that I loved, and finding a very cruel interface between them. Really, you know, that was where I seemed, that's where a lot of my kind of concern seemed to emanate from.
So I'm sorry, I just have to follow up. So you didn't have like a best friend or a brother who was gay and you had these intimate talks with them where you saw how heartbroken they were and how they tried to fight it. I mean, that's how I gained empathy. I had extensive talks with people who were gay and felt the pain and the sadness and then was activated or mobilized. You're saying that just through abstract sort of... sort of just like inferential conversations, you developed a deep sense of empathy for the conflict there?
Yeah.
That's amazing. I'm serious. I can't do the math. Like, you're like 20 years ahead of me when you're 19.
No, and this is why I've been such a terrific pain to all my poor family and people around me. Like, what happened? No, why? I don't know.
That's amazing. Okay.
I'm not 20. I don't know if I'm 20 years ahead. And I don't know if there was something in me. I still don't know if there was something in me that was attracted to conflict like that, but it came out of an empathetic place. It was just like, no, I didn't know anyone who was gay at all. I mean, very inferentially, maybe someone who might have been thinking about coming out on the Student Review staff might have winked, you know?
Right.
I mean, alluded to this whole world of experience. And then I just began to pick up and put pieces together and realize that, this was a really sore place to be. And again, you know, this was the Mormonism I loved and treasured was the one where we all got to come home to one another.
So what happened when that issue got published?
Oh, heck. No one got in trouble particularly, but it kind of, it cemented the reputation of the Review as a place where these kind of marginal topics would be talked about. And I know some members of the Review staff were really worried about that, because it was so perilous to be labeled outsider. I mean, it was one thing to be outsider funny. You know, it was another thing to be outsider searching, probing, sort of controversial. And folks were just concerned we were going to get our advertising pulled and we would cease to exist. So I think there was some internal concern. I mean, I know there was internal concern with the Review. I stepped away from the focus section after a year on deck there and became editor-in-chief and just kind of went to the humor section and kind of took myself out of that mix and let other people set the tone for a while, because, you know, it was clear to all of us by 91, 92 that, you know, whatever kind of glasnost moment or what kind of expansive experiment BYU had embarked on in the late 80s with recruiting faculty with more liberal perspectives, that the tide was turning, and it was turning from the top down, you know, and it was increasingly dangerous to be marginal at BYU.
Well, let's talk about that time. Did you ever have a class from Cecilia Farr?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Or Gail Houston?
Not with Gail, but Cecilia, absolutely. I remember clear as day sitting in, you know, a 60-person auditorium in the JKHB and taking her contemporary literary theory class and reading theory. And then she convened, we called it Feminist Home Evening. We would meet Monday. We would meet Monday nights and we did a reading group, and I read all the feminist classics and with a small group of students, some of whom were MA students, some of whom were undergrads. And Susan Howe was also a big influence on me. I remember she lent me a book of contemporary feminist theory, you know, and Gloria Cronin too was an influence on me.
So were you part of Voice?
Not for a long time. I had a hang-up about calling myself a feminist. It's crazy. But I did. I finally crossed over the dark side.
Right. So people have no idea why we're talking about Cecilia Farr, let alone who she is.
Oh, goodness.
So tell us a little bit about Cecilia Farr, and if you can remember a couple crazy things she said or did, just to give people a flavor for who she was.
Yeah. She was... She was a very, very convert to the church, born and raised in working class Pennsylvania. So already, you know, when she walked into a room, her whole manner of bearing, like, just kind of collided with Book of Mormon belt, you know, sensibility.
She was powerful. She was a powerful presence. Yeah.
She was, she was this, like, short, you know, descendant of Slovak, like tough, you know, rode her mountain bike, didn't speak with the lilt, didn't do the preciate, didn't like, you know, she was not from cultural Mormonism. She converted because of the powerful spiritual experiences she had, and in part because of the huge feminist kernels in Mormon theology, right? You know, so here she comes. She is one of the brightest doctoral students to come out of Michigan State, you know, and I've heard this from other people in the field. Oh, she was the smartest in the class, right? And BYU recruited her and hired her as a feminist literary theory. That was her profile.
Unbelievable.
They knew what they were getting. They knew.
Unbelievable.
She came as a feminist.
Oh, my gosh.
And she arrived right about the same time I did and taught, you know, women's literature, taught literary theory, taught American literature, and she wasn't the only one. There were other women in the department who were teaching women's literature, feminist literary theory, and by her third year Review, which was right at the time of my graduation in 93, the university decided not to review her contract. And, you know, the reasons they gave were not in line with the evidence. The American Association of University Professors did their own inquiry into the whole thing and lots of documentation compiled. And I mean, really, you know, some of the things that boiled down to that we knew were kind of sticking points were, you know, she'd given a pro-choice speech at a NOW rally in Salt Lake City, you know, and you know, some of her, yeah, she was also kind of accused of leading so many of us astray. You know, Voice had done some, Voice, which was the, you know, a feminist women's group at BYU. They met in like a space in the Kennedy Center, really. You know, I mean, we had done, Voice had done some excellent activism. You know, one time when the universe had run, you know, a story about, you know, increasing threats of assault around campus late at night, you know, and then someone had put out this, you know, the policy recommendation that young women should be curfewed after certain hours to be protected. Well, Voice responded by like stealing like BYU letterhead and typing up an official looking announcement saying that no, all young men will be under curfew and will have to call their Relief Society president to get an escort home so that dangerous creatures wouldn't be, not that like, right? Flipping the script, right? Who should live under a climate of restricted movement, right? Always the victims, right? So, I mean, this stuff was crazy. There was Take Back the Night in Provo. We marched down Center Street in Provo, Take Back the Night, 92, 93. I mean, there had never been anything like this before. And it was associated with Cecilia. They credit it not to this really, they didn't credit it to the students. They kind of pinned it on Cecilia, and she was not renewed at her third year review, which caused a big, big uproar. Not only, it was a national case. It wasn't just at BYU. The story of Cecilia made national.
Yeah, I was reading that the Chronicle of Higher Education wrote about it two times.
Oh, absolutely. We were on NPR. It was, I mean, it was not a small thing.
Yeah, it was huge. And it wasn't just Cecilia. There was David Knowlton.
Yeah. And that year when Cecilia, I remember being at a speak out again in the Mazur building. And I remember 10. I mean, we were counting how many women faculty were leaving that year because they knew the tide was turning. I mean, for many different reasons. Tomi Ann Roberts from psych, who was from psychology, who was not LDS and also hired as a feminist. She announced that she was taking another job. I think that was the year Martha Bradley left. I think, yeah, I mean, there were
Hal Miller.
Yeah, we were counting on our fingers the number of feminist and pro-feminist men faculty who were leaving, because everyone knew the tide was turning. Whatever expansive moment, you know, that the university had embarked on, it had decided by 92 to 93 that needed to end.
And that year 1993 doesn't just invoke BYU memories. I mean, that's obviously
that's the big year.
That's the big year of the September 6th
and the Three Great Dangers speech.
Right. Right. So there's
this great year to turn 21.
That's so crazy. Oh, what a life by the age of 21.
Oh, that we didn't even talk about the Gulf War and how that felt at BYU. That was hilarious.
So wasn't Eugene England leading war protests?
Gene wasn't. There were teach-ins. Hugh Nibley spoke at a teach-in. I remember seeing Hugh Nibley speak at a teach-in about how if the Book of Mormon proves nothing else, it proves that war is completely wasteful and destructive. So stop warmongering and read the Book of Mormon and marched off stage.
That's so awesome. What's a teach-in?
A teach-in is when you get about a dozen professors together, and this was in the Varsity Theater. Hugh Nibley in the Varsity Theater preaching against the Gulf War. Yes, it happened.
Wow.
You know, when you get like a bunch of professors and they all kind of speak from their bases of expertise, kind of informed responses to a controversial political, you know, happening. So, I had decided to be against the Gulf War in the most propositional and abstract of ways. And I remember walking to school, you know, in the cold, in this little dress I had sewn by myself that I was really proud of, because I'm a homemaker, camp crafter, and like having folks from my ward drive by and like yell out the window of the car, "You're an antichrist." I'm like, okay, great.
Man.
So anyway, that's just a side story. But 21, 1993, let's go back.
So student review, you know, feminism, you know, Cecilia Farr stuff, war stuff. Was there any other major blocks of experiences or memories that you think of when you reflect back on BYU?
Oh, we just had a lot of fun. I mean, as painful as it was, like, what an extraordinary time to be there. I would have never have encountered. I mean, I saw Carolyn Pearson perform Mother of the Morning at BYU. You know, I met, you know, lifelong friends, important Mormon intellectual figures like Jean England. Like, what a treat to be there, as difficult as it was. It was just a beautiful place and an important moment. I mean, one that's taken me 15 years to process and kind of like, or more, you know, to kind of figure out. But so much fun with smart Mormon kids.
It's one of the most magical times BYU will probably ever have. I mean, I'm biased, but that's how I look at it.
Yeah. Yeah, we ruled, John.
Well, I was just a
Glory
bystander.
Days.
I was living vicariously. I was a bystander.
No.
Who's this Joanna Brooks?
What is she doing? I know.
So, in parallel to all this at BYU, were you having doubts or questions about your own faith or testimony?
No. I mean, about my worthiness, about my right to belong to Mormonism, about my place in it all. You know, I mean, you know, I remember sitting in one of the science buildings with one of my roommates who, I mean, by the end of BYU, I had a gay roommate, you know, so not, you know, after, long after kind of the student review issue. You know, and like having some, you know, and then they recruit the leadership for the wards from the local, you know, stakes and wards in Provo, and sometimes they kind of dig deep, and some guy had given a less than satisfactory, you know, sacrament meeting talk that left us all feeling fairly deflated about being Mormon. And, you know, and I took my gay roommate outside and I just said to her, just ignore that, you know, Heavenly Father, Heavenly Mother, Jesus, that's it. Ignore that. You know, like I just, you know, my deep, tender feelings for, you know, those kind of central aspects of the faith, they never changed.
Really?
No.
And was there a point where you...
My chewy center, my soft, chewy, gooey center?
No. Was there ever a point where you dug into the history and learned all the, you know, polyandry and peepstones and all that?
No, it didn't bug me. I kind of came across it, but it didn't bother me.
Really?
No.
I read it,
it was cool. I mean, you know, I was okay with religions having particular forms, even if they were odd ones, right? You know, like every religion's got weirdness. It's okay. I mean, polygamy, yeah, that's a whole other story, but no.
Wow. So I read in the Sunstone article, or I looked you up, that at some point you actually sent your diploma back to BYU in protest. Is that right?
Yeah, I was going to say, we just about left the BYU chapter without mentioning that. Yeah, there was, right after the firings, there was a press conference at the old Seven Peaks Hotel.
I was there. I was there, actually.
You were there?
I was there.
So was I.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, and David Knowlton spoke, and Cecilia spoke.
I remember Paul Toscano being there, right?
Yeah, see, I didn't know who he was at that point.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, no, it's good. No, let's reminisce together. It's good. and Brian Waterman, a dear friend of mine, you know, still to this day, spoke. And, you know, and I spoke. And I, somewhere I have it written down, so what I said, but I remember really clearly that I, you know, I knew this was going to be something that was on TV and on the radio, and I knew that, you know, it'd been hard going to BYU, you know, as much as, I mean, I loved it, would never have traded it, but it was hard. It was deeply difficult being there, being 18, 19, 20 as an institution, and a culture had a major identity crisis, and kind of being right at the crosshairs of that, you know, Mormon feminist, right? A 20-year-old Mormon feminist, you know, a kid headed for a PhD program, an intellectual, not by pretense, that's just who I was made to be. I was just a brainy, geeky kid, you know, with a lot of words and a lot of curiosity and a giant heart. And the culture and institution I cared about most in the world had kind of decided that it wasn't okay. There wasn't really space anymore for Mormon feminists. And where was I supposed to go at that point? And so I wanted to get the word out that it wasn't a good time, right? That if the BYU recruiter was at your stake saying what my BYU recruiter had said to me, and he, I mean, he was a great guy. He didn't know. He wasn't in charge of, like, this is, you know, if someone was coming to your stake and saying to you, you know, like, yeah, it's great. Go to BYU. You'll have a great college experience. It's a great place for geeky, brainy, liberal, curious Mormon kids. This wasn't the time. Don't come now. Just save yourself some heartbreak and go to Stanford. You know, like, really, take right. the other way. It's just, it was just a really difficult time to be there, and no one deserved to kind of, I mean, you know, most of us have enough to figure out between 18 and 22, 23, 24, without, you know, kind of having to live through a major identity spasm in the most defining, all-encompassing institution, religion, tradition of our life, right? I mean, oh, so I remember saying that into the microphone. I'm like, and this is for young women, if, you know, if you have other, you know, and I said it pretty eloquently, I think. I was careful to kind of say it in a poetic way that wasn't hurtful, but I was like, this place isn't big enough right now for your dreams. You know, if you're a young woman and you're kind of thinking about coming here, you know, and it kind of to seal the point, I just kind of like sent out and I'm giving my diploma. And so I did. I sent it back. My sister actually sent hers back a few years later in solidarity. It was very sweet of her. And I got a nice letter from Rex Lee, you know, before he died, saying, you know, if you ever want it, we have it. So
that's nice.
Yeah. Oh, it was very, very nice. Very, very kind.
Hmm. So, then, what happened to Joanna Brooks? Like, I'm sure a lot happened, but I'm most, as a first question, there's two kind of questions that come to my mind. Is the first is, what was your faith curve? What did your faith curve do after leaving BYU? And how did you work, you know, how did you work with that? And then we'll talk about your husband in just a second. But
yeah, you know, so I went to LA and I entered this PhD program, and you know, I felt like I had like ashes dripping from my ears. I mean, I had you know, like there was some kind of physical consequence. I was sick for a couple years. Like my body actually registered all the stress of the BYU years. I don't want to sound dramatic, but there were some kind of tricky years after a couple of years getting into the PhD program, and then, you know, having this tremendous like weight of experience that I didn't know how to talk about to anybody. You know, there were very few people in the context of the PhD program who could really understand. I mean, so many people of faith hiding in the closet in academia, hello, everywhere, especially in literature programs. It's full of closeted Jehovah's Witnesses and Catholics, you know, but like, you know, so I didn't have anywhere I could really process everything that I'd just been through out loud. And my family wasn't that spot for me either, because, you know, being, you know, very devout, very observant, you know, I'd just broken their hearts with what I'd done. And so I, you know, I attended a singles ward in Los Angeles as I was pursuing my, you know, PhD. Really, really loved my PhD. Really loved being in Los Angeles. That was a city that my grandfather's side of the family had been in since the 1860s. They were Basque immigrants. And I felt a great tie there. And it was a wonderful moment for the labor movement in Los Angeles. And so I kind of got involved in all this really interesting immigrant labor organizing stuff that was happening. And, you know, ended up kind of channeling and kind of reliving and living out some of the activist impulses, and also kind of channeling and living out my own sense of exile, you know, through the venue of labor activism, which is a really funny fit. You know, it was awesome. I'd be like, I know I am the only Mormon here. You know, like, I got arrested a couple of times at like labor civil disobedience things downtown, like on the bus with all these like Salvadorian political refugees and different folks. And I'm like, yeah, I'm a political refugee too. You know, I'm just a Mormon feminist, you know, like, and you know, so that was like amazing life experience. And Los Angeles, I was a great place to kind of hide out from the purge for a little while, because, you know, urban wards are different, you know, university wards can be different. I got some really great opportunities to, you know, put my gifts, you know, such as they are, to use for the church. I mean, that was what hurt so bad. It's like, you know, you're a brainy, geeky, loudmouth girl. You're never going to be homemaking later. but you love this church. Where are you supposed to contribute? Why did God give me this like load of, you know, words and ideas, and what am I supposed to do with it all? And so like I got to write, I served a stake mission, which was nice. And I got to write some, I got to write rewrite the words of a hymn for State Conference, and it was sung by this multicultural choir at the LA State Center. It was like one of my happiest days. I got to write a play telling the life story of an African-American convert to Mormonism and using some of the insights from like organizing in communities of color in Los Angeles and studying literatures of color at the university. And kind of, I felt like I got a few chances when I was in LA to exercise my gifts. But there were definitely some hard times too, and hard moments too. Very uneven moments in my own faith journey, you know, trying to contribute where I could, but still feeling extremely hurt and guarded, and basically kind of unworthy to be a full participant in Mormon life, and maybe angry and resentful too, but mostly just processing a tremendous amount of experience and trying to come to terms with it all. And then, you know, here you are in your 20s, so you're trying to figure out how to make a life path too, because you're in a singles ward and everyone's looking around and trying to figure out, like, where was I supposed to go next? Like, who would marry me? You know, like, just a heap of trouble.
Right. So just as a pause, so your activism at BYU caused some rifts in your family?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, my folks, you know, they are wonderful, very devoted people. And they're like engineers, you know, they're analytical, they're not liberals, they're not intellectual identified, even though they're both tremendously brainy. Just, you know, I'm very different than them in that way. And, you know, I know that the publicity of what happened at BYU ended up causing them some shame. And, you know, no one wants to cause their parents some shame, but at the same time, you know, I was a 20-year-old kid and my worldview had just exploded. So,
right.
You know, I really couldn't help them out any. You know, I was, you know, so, you know, that was hard for them, I know.
You were just trying to keep the wheels on the wagon.
Yeah. All I wanted to be was a Mormon girl, you know.
Right.
Oh, boy.
And you have one sister or?
I have two sisters who are twins and a little brother. I'm the oldest of four.
Okay. So was there a point where your testimony crumbled or crashed or tanked or?
No, because you know it was fed all the way through by like these tremendously powerful but very personal experiences. You know, in dreams, feeling the presence of ancestors, you know, just there was a lot of comfort, you know, and I prayed pretty consistently. I've managed to pray the whole time, you know, like even when I have not been a perfect Mormon, I've been able to pray and get huge comfort instantly from Heavenly Father. And, you know, so that was always intact. That was always there. It's always been there. You know, it's just like just processing a lot of the hurt I felt was, you know, caused some unevenness in, you know, how often I went to church. Maybe even though I held callings, you know, I served, but no, I didn't. I don't know if there was a crash. It was just kind of a tremendous sadness, you know, and anger. Just not feeling like I had a place. In my own home anymore.
So would you characterize your beliefs now as sort of being traditional, orthodox, sort of Mormon views on theology and
no.
Doctrine?
No. I think one of the things about one of the ways I've reconciled, you know, coming into my adulthood as a thinking person and a reading person and a searching person with the strong feelings I have is that I've kind of become agnostic on most specific theological questions. You know,
Like,
you know, I don't need to know. It's just not, I mean, when I pray, I feel comfort. That's enough for me. And it's enough. And when I am with Mormon people, I feel a tremendous amount of spiritual power, and it really touches me, you know. And I don't need to know how many angels dance on the head of a pin. You know, I don't need to say that an institution is true. You know, I believe in God, whatever that means. I don't need to know what that means. I don't need to know. I know that God is loving. I know that God is just. I know that God is merciful. You know, the language through which I've come to know that loving, just, and merciful God is the language of Mormonism. That is the language I still pray in. That's my home tradition. That's enough for me. God's going to work out the rest. I don't, you know, I'm curious about theological questions. You know, I love thinking about the particular ways Mormonism teaches us to understand divinity, to understand our responsibility to one another. I feel very responsible to Mormon history. I feel very responsible to specific aspects of Mormon theology that I think are, you know, very ennobling and very liberating. I think Mother in Heaven's fabulous, you know. But I don't hang on those things. I have just a very personal sense of the goodness of God and of my responsibility to Mormon tradition, and that's enough.
When I was a boy each week, on Sunday we would go to church and pay attention to the priest. He would read the holy word and consecrate the holy bread, and everyone would kneel and bow. Today the only difference is everything is holy now. Everything is holy now. And when I was in Sunday school, we would learn about the time Moses split the sea in two, and Jesus made the water wine. And I remember feeling sad. Miracles don't happen still, but now I can't keep track, 'cause everything's a miracle. Everything's a miracle. Wine from water is not so small, but an even better magic trick. Hear it all. So the challenging thing becomes not to look for miracles, but finding where there isn't one. When holy water was rare at best, it barely wet my fingertips, but now I have to hold my breath. Swimming in a sea of it. It used to be a world half there, heaven's second rate hand me down, but I walk it with a reverent air, 'cause everything is holy now. Testament, that'd be very hard to say. See another new morning come, say it's not a sacrament. I tell you that it can't be done. This morning outside I stood, saw a little red-winged bird shining like a burning bush, and
and singing like a scripture verse. It made me want to bow my head. I remember when church let out, how things have changed since then. Everything is holy now. It used to be a world half there, heaven's second rate hand me down. But I walk it with a reverent air, 'cause everything is holy.